Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne. Chapter 29, in which certain incidents are narrated which are only to be met with on American railroads. The train pursued its course, that evening, without interruption, passing Fort Saunders, crossing Cheyenne Pass, and reaching Evans Pass. The road here attained the highest elevation of the journey, 8,092 feet above the level of the sea. The travelers now had only to descend to the Atlantic by the limitless plains leveled by nature. A branch of the Grand Trunk led off southward towards Denver, the capital of Colorado. The country round about is rich in gold and silver, and more than 50,000 inhabitants are already settled there. 1,382 miles have been passed over from San Francisco in 3 days and three nights. 4 days and nights more would probably bring them to New York. Phileas Fogg was not as yet behindhand. During the night, Camp Wabuck was passed on the left. Lodge Pole Creek ran parallel with the road, marking the boundary between the territories of Wyoming and Colorado. They entered Nebraska at 11, passed near Sedgwick, and touched at Julesburg on the southern branch of the Platte River. It was here that the Union Pacific Railroad was inaugurated on the 23rd of October, 1867, by Chief Engineer General Dodge. Two powerful locomotives, carrying nine cars of invited guests, among of whom was Thomas C. Durant, vice president of the road, stopped at this point. Cheers were given, the Sioux and Pawnees performed an imitation Indian battle, fireworks were let off, and the first number of the Railway Pioneer was printed by a press brought on the train. Thus was celebrated the inauguration of this great railroad, a mighty instrument of progress and civilization, thrown across the desert and destined to link together more cities and towns which do not yet exist. The whistle of the locomotive, more powerful than Amphion's lyre, was about to bid them rise from the American soil. Fort McPherson was left behind at 8 in the morning, and 357 miles had yet to be traversed before reaching Omaha. The road followed the capricious windings of the southern branch of the Platte River. On its left bank, at 9 the train stopped at the important town of North Platte, built between the two arms of the river, which rejoin each other around it and form a single artery, on a large tributary whose waters empty into the Missouri a little above Omaha. The 101st meridian was passed. Mr. Fogg and his partners had resumed their game. Not one, not even the dummy, complained the length of the trip. Fix had begun by winning several guineas, which he seemed likely to lose. He showed himself a not less eager whist player than Mr. Fogg. During the morning, chance distinctly favored that gentleman. Trumps and honors were showered upon his hands. Once, having resolved on a bold stroke, he was on the point of playing a spade when a voice behind him said, "I should play a diamond." Mr. Fogg, Ewood, and Fix raised their heads and beheld Colonel Proctor. Stamp Proctor and Phileas Fogg recognized each other at once. "Ah, it's you, is it, Englishman?" cried the colonel. "Is it you who are going to play a spade?" "And who plays it?" replied Phileas Fogg coolly, throwing down the ten of spades. "Well, it pleases me to have it diamonds," replied Colonel Proctor in an insolent tone. He made a movement as to seize the card which had just been played, adding, "You don't understand anything about whist." "Perhaps I do, as well as another," said Phileas Fogg, rising. "You only have to try, son of John Bull," replied the colonel. Ewa turned pale, and her blood ran cold. She seized Mr. Fogg's arm and gently pulled him back. Passepartout was ready to pounce upon the American, who was staring instantly at his opponent, but Fix got up, and going to Colonel Proctor said, "You forget that it is whom I you have to deal with, sir, for it was I whom you not only insulted but struck." "Mr. Fix," said Mr. Fogg, "pardon me, but this affair is mine and mine only. The colonel has again insulted me by insisting that I should not play a spade, and he shall give me satisfaction for it." "When and where you will," replied the American, "whatever weapon you choose." Ayuda in vain attempt to retain Mr. Fogg, as vainly as the detective endeavor to make quarrel with his. Passepartout wished to throw the colonel out of the window, but a sign from his master checked him. Phileas Fogg left the car, and the American followed upon the platform. "Sir," said Mr. Fogg to his adversary, "I am in great hurry to get back to Europe, and any delay whatever will be greatly to my disadvantage." "Well, what's that to me?" "Sir," said Mr. Fogg very politely, "after our meeting at San Francisco, I determined to return to America and find you as soon as I had completed the business which called me to England." "Really? Will you appoint a meeting for 6 months hence?" "Why not 10 years hence?" "I say 6 months," returned Phileas Fogg, "and I shall be at the place of the meeting promptly." "All this is an evasion," cried Stamp Proctor, "now or never." "Very good. You are going to New York?" "No." "To Chicago?" "No." "To Omaha?" "What difference is it to you? Do you know Plum Creek?" "No." "It's the next station. The train will be there in an hour, and we will stop there 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, several revolver shots could be exchanged." "Very well," said Mr. Fogg. "I will stop at Plum Creek." "And I guess you'll stay there, too," added the American insolently. "Who knows?" replied Mr. Fogg, returning to the car as coolly as usual. He began to reassure Eoda, telling her that blusterers were never to be feared, and begged Fix to be his second at the approaching duel, a request which the detective could not refuse. Mr. Fogg resumed the interrupted game with perfect calmness. At 11 o'clock, the locomotive's whistle announced that they were approaching Plum Creek Station. Mr. Fogg rose and, followed by Fix, went out upon the platform. Passepartout accompanied him, carrying a pair of revolvers. Eoda remained in the car, as pale as death. The door of the next car opened, and Colonel Proctor appeared on the platform, attended by a Yankee of his own stamp as his second. But just as the combatants were about to step off the train, the conductor hurried up and shouted, "You can't get off, gentlemen." "Why not? We are 20 minutes late. We shall not stop. But I'm going to fight a duel with this gentleman." "I'm sorry," said the conductor, "but we shall be off at once. There's the bell ringing now." The train started. "I'm really very sorry, gentlemen," said the conductor. "Under any other circumstances, I should have been happy to oblige you. But after all, as you have not had time to fight here, why not fight as we go along?" "That wouldn't be convenient, perhaps, for this gentleman," said the colonel in a jeering tone. "It would be perfectly so," replied Phileas Fogg. "Well, we really are in America," thought Passepartout, "and the conductor is a gentleman of the first order." So muttering, he followed his master. The two combatants and their seconds and the conductor passed through the cars to the rear of the train. The last car was only occupied by a dozen passengers, who the conductor politely asked if they could not be so kind as to leave it vacant for a few moments, as the two gentlemen had an affair of honor to settle. The passengers granted the request with alacrity and straightway disappeared on the platform. The car, which was some 50 feet long, was very convenient for their purpose. The adversaries might march on the end of the other aisle and file at their ease. Never was a duel more easily arranged. Mr. Fogg and Colonel Proctor, each provided with 2 6-barreled revolvers, entered the car. The seconds remaining outside shut them in, and they were to begin firing at the first whistle of the locomotive, after an interval of 2 minutes. What remained of the two gentlemen could be taken from the car. Nothing could be more simple. Indeed, it was all so simple that Fix and Passepartout felt their hearts beating as if they would crack. They were listening for the whistle agreed upon, when suddenly savage cries resounded in the air, accompanied by reports, which certainly did not issue from the car where their duelists were. The reports continued in front and the whole length of the train. Cries of terror proceeded from the interior of the cars. Colonel Proctor and Mr. Fogg, revolvers in hand, hastily quitted their prison and rushed forward where the noise was most clamorous. They perceived that the train was attacked by a band of Sioux. It was not the first attempt of these daring Indians, for more than once they had waylaid trains on the road. 100 of them had, according to their own habit, jumped upon the steps without stopping the train, with the ease of a clown mounting the horse at full gallop. The Sioux were armed with guns, from which came their reports, to which the passengers, who were almost all armed, responded by revolver shots. The Indians had first mounted the engine, and half-stunned the engineer and stoker with blows from their muskets. A Sioux chief, wishing to stop the train but not knowing how to work the regulator, had opened wide instead of closing the stem valve, and the locomotive was plunging forward with terrific velocity. The Sioux had at the same time invaded the cars, skipping like enraged monkeys over the roof, thrusting open doors and fighting hand to hand with the passengers. Penetrating the baggage car, they pillaged it, throwing the trunks out of the train. The cries and shots were constant. The travelers defended themselves bravely. Some of the cars were barricaded and sustained a siege, like moving forts carried along at a speed of 100 miles an hour. Eoda behaved courageously from the first. She defended herself like a true heroine with a revolver, which she shot through the broken windows whenever a savage made his appearance. 20 Sioux had fallen mortally wounded to the ground, and the wheels crushed those who fell upon the rails as if they had been worms. Several passengers, shot or stunned, lay on the seats. It was necessary to put an end to the struggle, which had lasted for 10 minutes, and which would result in the triumph of the Sioux if the train was not stopped. Fort Kearney Station, where there was a garrison, was only 2 miles distant, but that once passed, the Sioux would be masters of the train between Fort Kearney and the station beyond. The conductor was fighting beside Mr. Fogg when he was shot and fell. At the same moment he cried, "Unless this train is stopped in 5 minutes, we are lost." "It shall be stopped," said Phileas Fogg, preparing to rush from the car. "Stay, monsieur," cried Passepartout. "I will go." Mr. Fogg had not time to stop the brave fellow, who, opening a door unperceived by the Indians, succeeded in slipping under the car, and while the struggle continued and the balls whizzed across each other over his head, he made use of his old acrobatic experience, and with amazing agility worked his way under the cars, holding on to the chains, aiding himself by the brakes and the edges of the sashes, creeping from one car to another with marvelous skill, and thus gaining the forward end of the train. There, suspended by one hand between the baggage car and the tender, with the other he loosed the safety chains, but, owing to the traction, he would never have succeeded in unscrewing the yoking bar, had not a violent concussion jolted this bar out. The train, now detached from the engine, remained a little behind, whilst the locomotive rushed forward with increased speed. Carried on by the force already acquired, the train still moved for several minutes, but the brakes were worked and at last they stopped, less than 100 feet from Kearney Station. The soldiers of the fort, attracted by the shots, hurried up. The Sioux had not expected them, and decamped in a body before the train entirely stopped. But the passengers counted each other on the station platform. Several were found missing, among others the courageous Frenchman whose devotion had just saved them. End of chapter 29. Read by David Russell. For Lit to Go. Available on the web at fcit.usf.edu.